Looking back on his Kansas childhood for an essay in The New Yorker, Kevin Young remembers reading Robinson Crusoe, the famous novel about a shipwrecked sailor on a faraway island. It really spoke to him as a fifth grader in Kansas, which might seem odd, considering how far he was from the ocean. But he writes that he felt shipwrecked himself, stranded and landlocked on the strange Isle of Topeka. Kevin Young's new book of poetry is very much about the strange Isle of Topeka. The book is called Brown, as in Brown versus Board of Education, John Brown's raid, and the color of the author's skin. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Kevin Young is with us now to talk about his book, his life, and Kansas on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
You are the poetry editor for The New Yorker, which is a huge accomplishment, as is a new book of poems. But I really want to start with that line about feeling shipwrecked in Topeka.
As the essay goes on to talk about, I had driven two cars. I hadn't done the driving. I was only nine, from the East Coast to Kansas. And it was the heat wave of 1980. And I remember it being 112 a lot. And I remember seeing 119 on a bank somewhere in the Midwest. And, you know, getting to Kansas, it was a bit of a shock, but it was also sort of the differences that I describe in the book of, you know, being in this classroom and sort of exiled to the back to read books. And it was really interesting and shaped who I am. I don't think if I had read Robinson Crusoe for a book report, I would have become a writer. But also, I think Kansas was really important, and some of the things I write about in Brown, think about Kansas more broadly and the ways that it influenced me.
You went to the church where Linda Brown of Brown versus Board of Education played the piano and where her father had been a minister. And it seems like you look at a lot of what you experienced in Topeka through that lens. Like, what would Reverend Brown think if he could see you, however many years later, doing X, Y, or Z?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they're governing spirits of the book. And I knew that somewhere I want to write a poem eventually about what it meant to go to that church and to hear Linda Brown, who was so powerful and is now no longer with us, but with us always in so many ways. And I can still hear her voice. She was a great singer, a great piano player and organ player. And, you know, I thought of it eventually, not at the time, but as history singing right in front of you. And I think that's really part of the power of what I was trying to think about in the book, is the way that history is always personal. We interact with public history in a personal way, and how the sacrifices and efforts of people like Linda Brown and Reverend Brown shaped America and reshaped my life, but all of our lives.
Can you talk a little bit about how their legacy shaped your life, not just in this big public way, but in a personal way?
Well, personally, you know, they helped. They were some of the rock that this church was built on. It's an older church, an AME church in Topeka, St. Mark's, and it has this historic place. It helped me understand just personally how history was connected. Of course, Brown v. Board was reopened after I started going to church there for the very original reasons to help desegregate Topeka itself. But I also felt connected to other Black figures from Topeka, whether it's Langston Hughes or Gwendolyn Brooks, who I came to know were from there, but also people like Aaron Douglas, the terrific illustrator and artist who did many of the covers from the Harlem Renaissance of Langston Hughes, among others, who was born in Topeka and went to Topeka High, which was a rival high school, but we still celebrate him nonetheless.
The title of your book is Brown. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I was really interested in brownness in all different ways, some of which you mentioned. You know, James Brown makes an appearance, John Brown, who I remember seeing so vividly in the murals in the Topeka State Capitol building. And they were just so fearsome and awe-inspiring, and I wanted to think about that. And also just brownness in general and what it meant to be Black in Topeka, but also in the South, which kind of closes the book, is thinking about that. So I really wanted to think about race, but also about culture and about color.
We'll get into this through a couple of specific poems in just a bit, but when you say what it was like to be black in Topeka, what was that like for you?
It was both like being black anywhere and also quite different. I definitely experienced a very specific kind of racism that I think the book tries to contend with. There's a lot of poems about playing sports, for instance. One about playing on an all-black baseball team, and this is in the 80s, and winning the division, and the opposing team, who was majority white, the parents pretending they forgot the trophies because they couldn't stand to give them to us. And that kind of stuff makes you think a lot. It was very much the kind of things that you see play out in broader sports even now. And quite specifically in my book, I really want to juxtapose some of those my experiences, say playing sports, with Hank Aaron in this instance, and Hank Aaron's hate mail that he got for beating Ruth's record. I had these sort of separate poems, and at one point the book had section of more famous people and their struggles or their joys, and quite different poems about my childhood. And then I realized these things spoke to each other. And I think when it became the book it is now is when I started connecting those and putting them next to each other and starting to have them talk to each other. And then I ended up writing poems about my son and his childhood and thinking about that too.
I do want to have you read a couple of selections this morning, and we're going to start with the last few lines of a poem that's about wrestling. You've mentioned that there are a lot of poems about sports in this book, and specifically, there are tons of poems about wrestling. Like, I think most of the poems that exist about wrestling might be in this book.
Wrestling,
Wrestling.
yeah. I mean, it's such a ancient art, and it's so important. Of course, as you know, in the Midwest, it's really Iowa and Kansas, places like that, is where wrestling is really keen. And it taught me a lot, and a lot of good things. And then you have to starve yourself, and
Yeah, I was.
it's a kind of strange physical, intense thing. And the season lasts forever, but there was really some things that taught me. And this poem, City, really thinks about that in a specific way.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so it begins with this grueling training regimen that you and your teammates were on leading up to this big citywide wrestling match. And I just want to say, like, it seems to me that the point of that is largely how bad you wanted this and how hard you had been working. But can you describe some of that to us before we dive into the end of the poem, which takes a
Oh, it's
turn?
just gruesome. I mean, one of the things I mentioned is, and this happened more when I wrestled in high school, that people would have beards, and if your beard was too long, they would be seen like as a potential weapon. And so I remember this kid having to shave, and they were like, "Well, I'll find your razor." And the ref came up with this razor that who knows where it was from or when, and he had to shave with no shaving cream in the glare or glint of the paper towel dispenser. It was pretty grim, but that I also saw these great feats of strength and of that I also talk about in some of the other poems.
Okay, well, I want you to read the end of this poem on page 49, starting with After I Told Mom.
This is from City. After I told Mom I knew I'd win, she only half believed me, said hope was good to have. Later, I waved to her from the podium after winning City, my smile as long as the shot she'd thought I had. How I loved Coach and his belief, the metal mine. Earning my letter jacket's giant T, I was called to his office, I thought, to shake hands. Instead, he asked, "You can dance, right?" Why don't I moonwalk for him and the boys? A ring of fellow coaches grinned. Stunned, I did not laugh or dance or do that backwards glide he wanted. I still haven't a clue which race he thought he'd have me run, my medal long lost. That sunny morning, right before life science, long after history.
Oh, I cringed when I read it, and I'm cringing now. I mean, basically like you had just had this great achievement and your coach wants you to dance for him?
I guess he thought the moonwalk was popular or something. You know, for me, it was really like this haunting thing that, you know, and my mom, I think, was really supportive. I still remember the meal she cooked me the day before, you know, because you had to carbo load. But, you know, he was really, I think, trapped. And he wanted to trap me in a way. And
What do you
I
mean
felt
by
like,
that?
I mean, I feel like he was trapped in this racism. He was very supportive and almost up until that moment. You know, almost literally, if you had told me, I would have thought he was a really good guy. He was certainly a good coach. And I had some bad coaches, which are in some of the other poems. But, you know, it just showed me a little bit about how even someone who could be generous in some ways, still that racism aided him, and he couldn't not humiliate me. You know, and I remember him vividly saying to me, "You know, you have a shot to win," which was really like a powerful thing for me because I had no idea, you know. But it was a little like it taught me a lot about art and struggle and, you know, I suppose poetry in some way. There was something about him, and I think not just about him, this coach, but I think about the ring of other coaches, what they, you know, was going through their minds. And I feel like, you know, if they had known I was a poet, maybe they wouldn't have, because poets get their, you know, get to write about these things later and point out these kind of hypocrisies that I don't mean to only be about him, but about a place and a time, but also our place and our time.
You know, I mean, it is interesting that the situation you were describing earlier about the parents who couldn't bear to give an all-black baseball team a trophy, and then this coach who is great and supportive until you've got that medal from your victory in wrestling. I mean, what is there something to that?
I suppose. I mean, what I like about the poems is the poems try to speak for themselves and try to just recount it as accurately as possible. And they try to make myth, but also, you know, myth in the original sense of a powerful originating story and tale that might be true. And for me, that's what the point of the poem is. The poem kind of completes the experience in a way. And I find readers do too. They are the ones who breathe life into it, and maybe they see themselves in the poems in some way, and I hope sort of connect to what it meant for a young boy who was pretty sensitive and, you know, but had this one thing he was good at in terms of, I was good at sports actually. That sort of, how do you nurture that and not bespoil that? And I'm not sure racism has an answer for that, even for those who are successful.
You know, the way that poem ends, that this all happened right before life science and long after history, it's clear that on some level you're talking about the schedule of your classes in school and when your coach called you
Sure.
in to talk to him, but that this happened long after history is so poignant.
Right. Well, and there's actually another poem called History about some of these struggles too, which I was aware of. But I was also thinking, of course, about this big H history that we're all part of. And how do we kind of answer those questions and get beyond them? And, you know, there are poems in the book that think about this black boyhood in Kansas, but also think about black boyhood now, thinking about my son, but also thinking about victims of violence, police violence especially. There's later a suite of poems for Trayvon Martin, and poems that think about what it means to grow up now. I think I would have hoped I would only be writing about the past, but I find in writing about the past, I'm really writing about now.
Yeah, I mean, you do have several poems in the new book, Brown, about not being a kid yourself, but about being a parent and watching a childhood. And I am curious about this larger question about how parenting has changed your meditation on your own childhood, the Topeka piece of it, but the rest of it too?
I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? I think that for me, everyone's trying to keep their kids safe, whole, and then hopefully to let them fly on. And this crisis, which is not new, is, I think, threatens that. And the humanity of that, the fact that sometimes people argue over whether or not, say, Black Lives Matter, or that people shouldn't be shot, I think is really troubling. And I say that in an intimate way. And for me, I wanted to kind of humanize that feeling. But I also was just trying to write poems about now. I think that people, you see people writing, even if you write a poem about the past, you end up writing about now. And I also think that what would it look like to be a poet or writer writing about something so divorced from now that it can't be understood? So I think it's important to have those echoes. And I think you see them in our pop culture right now. You see them in what I think is a really rich time in, say, poetry. And I see that daily in my work as the editor of The New Yorker. And I see that as the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, where we, you know, do keep the history and culture of African diaspora alive in our archives and in our activities.
I want to get back to your career now in a little bit, but getting back to history, I mean, a character from what here is local history, who you mentioned several times, is John Brown. And you don't just write about the person and his historical role, but also the way he's portrayed in the state capitol where you went on field trips.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, those images by John Stewart Curry are haunting still. And I've been back there reading recently, and a bunch of us, you know, talked about what it was like to see those as a young person or even today, and the power of those images of John Brown.
What was it like for you to see those images? I mean, he is just like this wild-eyed guy with the Bible and the shotgun and a tornado.
Yeah, I think it's, I think that tornado is the right metaphor. I mean, I think it was just like seeing the wildness itself, an avenging angel of sorts.
I mean, what does the story of John Brown and John Brown's raid mean to you? How do you hear that story?
You know, I once, for a earlier book for the Confederate Dead, used John Brown's supposed last words, where he on the way to the gallows said, "This is a beautiful country," which I think is a really profound and just, you know, haunting timing of that declaration, that I think he's also trying to claim and understand the beauty and the possibility and, the reckoning too. And I think that John Brown represents a notion of freedom in some sense, but also of that at all costs. And I think people, you know, smarter folks than me have written about his life and his cause. But I also think that people, we all of us are in that shadow of thinking about beauty, struggle, and loss, and what it means. I think that he's a powerful force and so integral to Kansas history. And Langston Hughes, one of his ancestors, the one he's named for, actually was part of that raid on Harper's Ferry.
You know, as not just a New Yorker, as you've mentioned, but someone who has a really prominent title at The New Yorker and other parts of your professional identity that are so closely linked to Harlem, for example, your professional identity is so wrapped up in the city you live in now. And I wonder if that makes you relate differently to your Kansas roots.
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, to me, say the Harlem Renaissance, of which Langston Hughes and Aaron Douglas were so a part, had a lot to do with Kansas. You know, they both lived there and came here to affect change and change culture. So, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, which is where I, you know, where the Schomburg Center started in 1925, in the height of the Harlem Renaissance, I think that it really speaks to Kansas. So for me, it doesn't feel as far as you might. If anything, I feel connected to know that these places, which on a map may seem far, aren't in the imagination and aren't in the Black experience.
You have a suite of poems called Ad Astra Per Aspera, which, of course, is the Kansas state motto. I'm curious about what those words mean to you, Ad Astra Per Aspera.
I mean, you know, to the stars through difficulty. I think it's the most beautiful state motto and the most apt. It seems so much how I felt about Kansas, where in 5 minutes I could be outside of town staring up at the stars, which were this great consolation for me as a moody teenager. So for me, like, it's both literal and, you know, symbolic, but it also is emblematic, I think, of Kansas striving, Kansas history, and Kansas thought. I always, like any of the writer friends I know who are from Kansas, of which there are quite a number of Topeka poets, Ed Skoog, Ben Lerner, these are terrific writers you should know if you don't already. And there's many more who, you know, we just love that. So I had to write a poem about
It is a very poetic state motto.
that.
Before we go, I do want you to read the poem that begins that section of the book, the Ad Astra Per Aspera section. And the poem is called Western Meadowlark, but I wonder if there's anything you want to say about this poem first, or if you just want to read it.
Well, there's three little parts, and they each take the state bird, the state animal, and the state flower, which you, I'm sure your readers know. And Western Meadowlark is the first one. And it really is thinking about sort of what, not just what the meadowlark would see literally, but sort of what one sees looking at it from this distance. Western Meadowlark. Land of unlikely. Land of no sea. Land of all you can eat. Land of 17. Land of silos, missile and otherwise. Land of squinting eyes. Land of wheat and Milo. Land of bejeweled jorts. Land of A&W, of Gates barbecue. These are my dressiest shorts. Land of gray ash. Land of acid wash. Land of winded cough, of neatly piled trash. Land of squat buildings and broad slate sky. Land of land never ending. Land of doesn't matter why. Land of soft serve. Land of dead man's curve. Land of lost mutts. I'm not racist, but land of summer severe. Land of persevere. Land of nothing near. Into this here strode tall John Brown, in one hand a Bible, the other a rifle, face more scowl than frown.
Kevin Young, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Young reading his poem Western Meadowlark from the book Brown. He's poetry editor for The New Yorker, and Brown is his new book. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're heading back to Kansas City with the streetcar. Do you want to see the streetcar line expand through Westport, south to UMKC? 816-235-2888. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, what's going on with the possible expansion of Kansas City's streetcar line? And why is there so much controversy surrounding the Westport piece of it? We'll dig into that now with our reporter and newscaster, Lisa Rodriguez. And you can call with your perspective at 816-235-2888. We want to know whether the streetcars changed your experience of Kansas City so far, and what the proposed expansion south to UMKC through Westport would mean to you. 816-235-2888. So, Lisa, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
What exactly is being proposed?
So, what's being proposed is It's a continuation of that starter line that runs downtown, and it would continue to run along Main Street all the way south to the UMKC campus. And so what's being asked of voters in this particular election, which is the third of kind of a tiered process, which we can get into later, is whether to authorize the imposition of sales and special property tax assessment, which would be the main funding mechanism for the line to UMKC.
And so the vote that's going on is actually somewhat confusing. How is this all being decided?
So it's, you know, although the streetcar is an asset that affects us throughout the city, the only people that can vote on the streetcar are those that live within a proposed special taxing district, which is called a Transportation Development District, or TDD. And only those people, which is about 30,000 registered voters, are eligible to vote. But in order to vote, they had to apply for a ballot, send that into the courthouse once they were approved for a ballot. Then they're mailed these ballots. Then they have to get them notarized and turn them in, which means at this point, the pool that has actually been approved for ballots is about 4,500.
So this is
less than 5,000 people.
Fairly confusing. What's the precedent for this approach? Is there a precedent for it?
It's a little complicated, but this is how elections for transportation development districts can be conducted under Missouri law, and it can be an effective way to do it. It's a little less, you know, publicized, but it's also a much more inexpensive way to run an election. If people have to apply for a ballot, that means that you're sending out 5,000 ballots rather than 30,000 ballots if you think that you're only going to have a turnout of 5,000 anyways, which is kind of the ideas behind it, that it's, you'll get the same turnout this way than you would in any special election.
The same number maybe, but not the same exact people.
Right.
And so that's sort of interesting. There are people who are so passionate about transportation in Kansas City, about the streetcar in particular. There are people who love the streetcar, love all things streetcar. There are critics of the streetcar, and a lot of those people can't vote. And I feel like it's killing them.
Right. People, I think, desperately want to be part of this conversation. But when you do get down to it, although there is a sales tax portion of it, which everyone who moves through that district would be affected by, the only people that are going to be on the hook for a property tax assessment are the people living in this district. And so it does, you know, by one argument, make sense that those are the people that should have this, should be able to make this decision. They're the one whose money is on the line.
And so this district is within a certain radius of the proposed stops?
Yes, of the proposed lines.
The proposed line.
Mm-hmm. And that really gets to the heart of what a lot of the debate has been about the streetcar. It's supposed to be about a one-third mile, a third of a mile distance from the streetcar line. That's what the Transportation Development District is. But if you look at it, it's not just a clean rectangle all the way down the line. It juts out at certain parts and a little farther than a third of a mile, a little less in other parts. And they say that accounts for kind of the walkability of that area. They make exceptions for commercial districts that they think would benefit greatly from having this streetcar line. So it's, people have accused it of being, you know, gerrymandered and, you know, in bits. And in the past, last year, there was a debate about why certain luxury apartments were included in the district while certain other ones weren't.
So some Westport business owners, not all, but some, are riled up about this proposed expansion. First of all, what is their beef?
Well, Westport is exactly one of those entertainment districts that is further than the third of a mile from the line. So that kind of juts out to include them. And obviously, you know, Westport businesses, that's a huge chunk of property tax assessments there because it's a big commercial district. And I think there are some businesses that think that's not really fair. They don't consider their entertainment district a walkable distance from the nearest stop, which the proposed stops right now would be at 39th and Main and then 43rd and Main, which it would be kind of on the outskirts of what we would consider the Westport area. They don't consider it walkable. They don't think it'll be a boon to the district. And I think as a business owner, you worry about your bottom line. You know, you don't want to see a property tax hike. But again, that's only some businesses. And other businesses will say, you know, we'll take that hit because it's gonna because we do believe that you know, this would be an opportunity for the district to develop all the way out to the streetcar line. This is good for the city.
So, but wouldn't it be the owners of the buildings anyway? I mean, so as business owners, they're typically tenants. So with this being based on property taxes, it's a little confusing.
Right, right. And you know, there's a lot of business owners in Westport that are building owners because of the, you know, historic nature of that district. But the other component is the sales tax district or the sales tax that they would be affected by. And Westport is an entertainment district that is already burdened by a lot of sales taxes. So we're looking at, you know, a sales tax in Westport jumping up to, you know, over 10% with the addition of a 1% sales tax.
The idea, though, of how walkable that is, it is so relative. I mean, if you were in New York City and someone pointed to the distance between 43rd and Westport and the heart of Westport and said, that's not walkable, people would laugh really, really, really hard.
You're right. You're right. It is relative. And we're not really a walking city yet. And I think that...
I love your optimistic yet.
And I think that's what a lot of streetcar proponents hope that having this line run through the city will encourage people to walk a couple extra blocks than they would, you know, than they would if they parked somewhere and walked. But I think 4 or 5 blocks in many cities is very walkable.
So as I've mentioned, there are some Westport business owners who have been really vocal in their opposition to this whole thing, but not all Westport business owners feel that way. What's sort of the other Westport business perspective that maybe hasn't gotten as much play?
I think the other Westport business perspective, I think they see an opportunity for growth because there is, you know, Westport, you know, the heart of Westport kind of, you know, runs up until Broadway. And while there are businesses between Broadway and Main, that's kind of a less developed part of Westport. And I think that there are business owners that see an opportunity for the entire district to grow and prosper and to connect Westport to other entertainment districts that are along the line.
So with the proposed expansion going south to UMKC, it is interesting to me that so much of the discussion is about Westport. I would think that this would have a huge impact on the plaza, on the museums, like the Nelson and the Kemper, that whole little area. And then also the university community and even Brookside, which would be in walking distance by some measures of the streetcar line. Why aren't we hearing as much about those communities?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that probably those who oppose something are going to be the loudest voices in the room sometimes. And I do think that there's a big part of this city that is very excited about the progress of the streetcar. And I just think those voices aren't quite as loud.
What questions do you have right now, despite your thorough reporting? Like things you're still really curious about, either thinking about the possibilities going forward with the streetcar or just about the process itself of deciding about this expansion?
Well, the process has been really interesting. I think that I wonder how this election will turn out. I think for the starter line, you know, there was an opposition to the starter line, but it wasn't nearly as organized or well-funded as it is now. It's the same group, and people oppose the streetcar for a lot of different reasons. Some people think it's just an ineffective, that rail transportation is an ineffective way to move people around. Some people oppose the taxing part of it. Some people simply think that the way that the election is being conducted isn't fair. And you know, it's I'll be interested to see how this turns out.
Well, only some people get to vote, but anyone can call. How would the proposed streetcar expansion affect you? 816-235-2888. We're going to be taking those calls in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Lisa Rodriguez on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with newscaster Lisa Rodriguez, who's been following the proposed streetcar expansion for KCUR. Hi again, Lisa.
Hi, Gina.
We have been asking what an expansion of the streetcar from Union Station south to UMKC would mean for you. So let's take some of your calls. I want to start by talking with, I'm not sure, is it Jean in Kansas City, Missouri?
Yes.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Here.
All right.
Yes. I want to give my viewpoint on this.
Go on ahead.
Yes, I'm a senior and I live on the trolley route. I am voting and I am going to vote no. And you would think because I'm a senior and I don't drive anymore because of vision problems that I would be delighted. But I'm not delighted to pay extra sales tax, and I am especially not delighted to pay more property tax. I'm on a fixed income. My house is my biggest expense. I've been here since 1985. I want to stay here, and I don't want to be driven out by having my property taxes go up.
So you feel like you'd be pushed out of your neighborhood by this?
It could be. I don't know. I haven't calculated exactly how much it comes to in additional property tax. But everyone says, the trolley is free. The trolley is free. Well, it's not going to be free for me.
All right.
And
yeah.
I'd rather use the money I pay an extra tax to take Uber, to tell you the truth.
Well, let's let Lisa Rodriguez respond to a little of this. Thank you, Jean, for calling.
I think that's an important point, and it's part of the reason that a few years ago a proposed streetcar that ran east to west also failed, because there are some people that find that an increased property tax assessment, that paying that extra sales tax simply isn't feasible. And that's also, I think, you know, for organizers, that's exactly why these are the people that are being asked to approve it.
Let's talk to Marianne in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, how about you?
I'm great. I am very happy to volunteer at Union Station at the information booth. And I'm just there one morning a week. But I get a lot of visitors who come into the station, and they're very happy to find out that there is a streetcar that will take them downtown. I give them a Visit KC map, and I show them all the things to see and do. And they always ask, well, can I get to the plaza? Because most visitors from out of town know something about the Country Club Plaza. I tell them it's proposed, and when they ask how can they get down there, I always recommend our public transportation system or Uber or taxi. I myself am also a public transportation user. I walk with a cane. Walking places is part of my exercise program. So walking 4 or 5 blocks from the bus to some place is not a problem for me. And I'm just really excited that the proposed line might be going through, because I know our visitors from out of town would really like it.
Marianne, do you talk to a lot of locals in that capacity too, a lot of local visitors to Union Station about the streetcar as well? Because that is actually, I mean, as far as I understand it, both one of the selling points of the streetcar, but also one of the criticisms is how it serves tourists, maybe, as opposed to locals?
Oh, the local folk who come in, parking in the parking garage or finding parking on the street, and they come into the station, maybe they're there to see the free model railroad or the history of the station. They often ask, where can I go on the streetcar line? I recommend like the Steamship Arabia or restaurants or Power and Light or Sprint Center or the Basketball Hall of Fame. And they're very happy to leave their car in the garage and use the streetcar to go north. I think they also would be very happy to take the streetcar and go south.
Lisa, tell me more about this, because Marianne is also making kind of an argument here that businesses near that streetcar line are being well served by it.
They are being well served by it. I've heard that from many business owners along the streetcar line. When it was under construction, maybe not so much, but now that it's open, I think it has spurred development. We've seen along that streetcar line businesses and restaurants and shops opening up, and I would say it's bustling, you know, that entire line. And I think the hope is that if voters approve the extension south, that the same thing would happen, and that entertainment districts and restaurants and shops that are already popular will be even better served by the streetcar line, and that there will be more kind of connective development along the whole route.
Let's talk to Rick in Lathrop, Missouri. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
Well, I want to share the history of this line. I was a boy in the 1940s and lived on the Country Club car line, which was a streetcar line the last to go in 1957, which went from the River Market through downtown on Main all the way out to the plaza, from the plaza and through UMKC and out to Waldo at 75th. That was the last line to go, and it was viable right up to the end. There was a move to try and preserve it. If they had, it would be there today. And the businesses boomed along that line, and they began to leave when it left in 1957. That's when Main Street began to deteriorate. And you can see right now it's come back because of the streetcar. That Country Club line was a marvelous way to travel. It had its, now, it did have its own right-of-way from the plaza south to Waldo, which is now for walkers and bike riders. That's still there. The line, the right-of-way is still there. But I can tell you for sure that was a viable line right up to the end. And Kansas City in the middle 40s still had a completely complete car line over the entire city, east, west, north, and south.
Rick,
all the way to Kansas City, Kansas, and Independence.
Have you gotten to ride the new streetcar?
No, I suffer from Parkinson's. I would love to. I've watched it because I have a deja vu. When I see that overhead line, it takes me back. I never thought I'd ever see that again because there were overhead lines, of course, all through the streetcar era, beginning back the early part of the 20th century when it was cable cars. But, my God, it was a real jerk from my memory to see that overhead trolley line again.
And you're happy to see it.
Well, I can tell you from history, it would boom. It brought so much. Well, the businesses along Main Street began to deteriorate in 1957 when the car line left. And it deteriorated badly for the next few decades. And where the car is now, you see businesses once again coming back.
Well, thank you, Rick. And Lisa, do people invoke history a lot in talking about this issue?
All the time. All the time. People who remember when there was last a streetcar in Kansas City. And he's right. It really just crisscrossed across the whole city. And what is what's kind of shocking is how quickly it went away.
Let's talk to Alan. Alan is calling us from North Kansas City. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Well, I'm terrific. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I don't know if your guests can answer or not, but what is the capital expenditure per mile of the streetcar line?
That is a very specific question. Lisa?
I wish that I could answer that question, but I don't have the answer to that one. I apologize.
I wonder, is there something under, I mean, it's fair to just want information. I'm curious whether there's a deeper question underlying that one.
Well, there certainly is. I'm wondering why we cannot build a bus that looks exactly like a streetcar and run it on infrastructure that already exists, including the proposed expansion route. What is so magical about rails?
That it's a really interesting question and probably could be another full discussion on it on its own. And I don't have the answer to that one either, but there does seem to be some sort of allure, some draw where people want to ride this shiny new streetcar in a way that they haven't taken to buses as much. And I don't know if it's the simplicity of it, but
I wonder about the very fact of the newness, because I have ridden the buses in Kansas City, and it was always interesting to me. I mean, I used to do it. I don't really anymore. But when I did, I remember being surprised that so many people had strong opinions about the buses, about how well the bus routes worked, who did not ride the bus. And I just wonder if maybe there's a fresh start that's part of what's going on.
Yeah, that's possible, but it's a really interesting question and something to I don't know, ponder.
Let's talk to Mike in Roland Park. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Great. I wanted to make two comments. I'll make a fast comment. The one on the poor lady that says she was worried about her property taxes. And I think that's one of the problems with all these campaigns. They don't get that you can't leave people out there hanging, that you can't leave people guessing, that you've got to tell people, yeah, and know that, you know, it's going to cost you maybe $100, maybe $200 max.
So you're saying the fact that she isn't sure whether she would be able to afford it.
Exactly. That's terrible. That's horrible on the part of the people who are trying to promote this thing. And I've lived in Kansas City since 1952. We lived at 57th and Paseo. My mother used to work at Cricket West on the Plaza, and I went to school at the Nelson Gallery. We would ride that streetcar all the way down the Plaza. My parents could afford it, even though they weren't very rich people. They were just ordinary people. All they had to have was one car for my dad to go to work. You know, and that's the kind of thing that mass transit does for a city. And I think it's a shame that people get caught up in all this tribalism of, oh, you know, gosh, it's four blocks away. That's nothing in terms of distance in walkable cities. I mean, holy cow, the best cities in the world besides Kansas City, like New York and Boston and Tokyo and Paris and Rome, people walk for blocks. I've got a grandmother that lived to be 102 years old because she walked all her life.
Well, Mike, I have a question. Sorry, that I asked one of our previous callers, who also remembered riding the earlier streetcar line from Kansas City's historic days. But you know, for you, have you been on the new one?
I'm ashamed to say no. I haven't been on it. Which is, you know, it's just a matter of, I don't know. I don't know what I'm waiting for.
Well, Lisa, okay, first of all, do you want to respond to anything that Mike has said?
Sure. I mean, he also brings up a valid point that a lot of, that we're authorizing, you know, or the people who are voting are authorizing, you know, a set group of people to impose a property and sales tax. We know that the sales tax would be 1%, at no more than 1%. It would last 30 years. The property, the special property assessment would be for 25 years. And I think on kctransit.com, there is a table that says, you know, an example of what it could be. But he's right that nowhere in the ballot language does it say exactly what that would be.
You know, he also brings up this idea about the PR campaign. And I wonder if there's anything else to be said about just how people are getting their information about what is being proposed, about how it's being voted on. Where is information coming from on this?
I think if you live outside of that streetcar district, you wouldn't know. It's a lot of... a lot of knocking on doors in that district, a lot of flyers, a lot of, you know, mailers in your mailbox. That's how the information is getting out, as well as KC Streetcar itself doing its own kind of social media campaign. So if you're already plugged into transit, you're getting the message. Otherwise, if you live in that district, that you're getting those mailers every day and people maybe knocking on your door on the weekends.
For the other part of what I was talking to Mike about, you know, this whole part about that he hasn't been on the streetcar yet, what do we know about how widely this is being used? Like, how viable has the first stretch, the starter line, been?
I would say it's been pretty successful by the measures the city has been using. There are certain parts of the city that use it more than others. So some of the lowest income parts of the city are not using it as much as, say, people who live in Midtown around the Plaza. But as far as city people who reported to a city survey, I think nearly 40% of the city has at least ridden it once.
So when will we know the outcome of this vote?
Ballots are due June 12th, so around then they'll have to count them all, since they come in a staggered way. So we'll know after June 12th.
Well, our time is up, but keep talking about streetcar expansion, everyone. The conversation can continue on Twitter. We are @KCURCST. Lisa Rodriguez, thank you so much for your reporting.
Anytime, Gina.
You can share this morning's conversations with anyone who might have missed them at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Kevin Young, whose new book of poems called Brown has been getting a lot of attention, and it's about his childhood in Topeka. Super interesting story. Check it out if you missed it. Tomorrow, why it shouldn't be so surprising that two new independent bookstores are opening in Kansas City this summer. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.